that we can look at and we can learn from his life. I trust you have too. I do want to say up front this evening that I don't want to be antisocial, but my wife and I and children will probably not be here very long afterwards. We'll have a little bit of snack, but tomorrow morning I'm going to be working in the cafe again. I usually start at 4:30 or so on Saturday mornings, but I have an important job of making donuts. I do have a friend that's helping me get started, so I don't have to. There's a picture of frying them, and then what our customers are expecting tomorrow morning. So if you're ever in Reading on a Friday, just Fridays and Saturdays, we make homemade donuts. All right, back to Daniel. Daniel chapter 6, a little bit of review. The three themes we've been looking at, and I hope to recap this at the end tonight, is purpose, prayer, and prophecy. Three different aspects of Daniel's life. And a review, chapter 1, what was chapter 1 about? His purpose. Daniel purpose not to eat the king's meat. Very good. And about how old was he? 13 to 17, somewhere in that range is what we scholars estimate how old he was. Daniel chapter 2 was about what? Nebuchadnezzar's dream and the statue, yes. Yeah, the image of the three different parts of it. And that was 2 years later, chapter 2 tells us. Chapter 3 was about what? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the fiery furnace. Very good. And that would have been sometime here. We don't know exactly how much later that was. Chapter 4 was, what was the story in there? The humbling of King Nebuchadnezzar, his pride, his humbling. He was walking in his palace and he said, look at this great city that I built for by my might and for my glory. And he's humbled for 7 years. Chapter 5. Pardon? Handwriting on the wall. Very good. Handwriting on the wall. Chapters 1 through 6 are primarily history. 7 through 12 are prophecy or visions. And chapters 2, starting verse 4 to the end of chapter 7, are written in what language? Aramaic. Very good. So I would like to just discuss, as we look at Daniel 6, I'd like to discuss how old he was at this time. So Daniel chapter 1 happens in 606 or 605. There's some you get slightly varying dates, but it was most common in 606 or 605. So we put it there. Daniel 5, we know when the Medes and Persians conquer Babylon from extra-biblical sources. That was in 539 BC. So you subtract that, and he's been captive for 67 years. And if he was 13 years old when he was taken as a captive, that would now make him 80. If this happened in the very first year of the Medes and Persians, this could have happened in the fifth year or even the tenth year. So he is, I think it's reasonable to say that he is 80 plus years old as we look at Daniel chapter 6 tonight. I wanted to touch on one other thing I did not get to finish last night. Evidence for Daniel being written by Daniel. So we talked about the prophecy last night and Antiochus, Epiphanes, and the Medes and Persians, how they fulfill that. And skeptics do not argue that Antiochus and Epiphanes doesn't fulfill the vision in Daniel 8 and then in Daniel 11. There's not really discrepancy about that. That's not really argued about. They realize that Antiochus, it's prophesied so detailed, it has to be that man. But what they argue about is that it was written after Antiochus lived, which would have been around the year 160. I think he died in 164. So they say Daniel had to have been a forgery written by someone else. And there's some reasons why we don't agree with that. There's actually a lot of evidence. I'm just going to throw a few points out. First of all, Jesus endorsed it. Matthew 24, verse 15, abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. So Jesus endorses it. The book itself says in 7 different places it has the phrase, I, Daniel. Put the references up there saying that Daniel has good history. It matches archaeology. Nebuchadnezzar, he says in Daniel 4 how he built Babylon and he bragged. There's archaeological evidence that he did the very same thing, that Babylon was captured without resistance. That's confirmed by extra-biblical sources. Daniel has very good history. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail of it. There's 15 Persian words in the book of Daniel, and skeptics say, well, see, the Medes and Persians hadn't yet conquered Babylon, and so therefore Daniel's a forgery. But if you look at those 15 words, every single one of those words is all relate to government and are considered Old Persian. Okay, Middle Persian would have been used around 165 when skeptics say that Daniel was actually written. So that is a very strong support. And then the Aramaic section in Daniel is written in Imperial Aramaic, and it matches other documents that are found from the same time area, same time era. And there's just some, there's some really, really solid evidence that Daniel actually wrote Daniel, outside of just Jesus endorsing it or Daniel himself endorsing it in the book. I think if you have an open mind and look at the evidence, it's a very strong case. If you want to watch something on that, Defending Daniel by Mike Winger, it's on YouTube or it's on his website, BibleThinker.org. Again, I think Jethro had asked me what some of my primary sources are for studying. Mike Winger has 4 videos on Daniel. I encourage you to watch them if you're interested in. He does mostly with prophecy. He does chapter 7 and 8, which we did last night. He does Daniel 9 and then Daniel 11 with 135 prophecies there. And then he has one on defending Daniel. Chuck Missler is also someone else I like to listen to on Daniel. I would say he has more bones to spit out when you're listening to him, but he's a very knowledgeable guy, very interesting to listen to. And then when I was at Bible School in Grenada, I think I mentioned the first night, Ryan Horst had done a study in Daniel, and that's what kind of inspired me to do it here. So, all right, Daniel chapter 6. Again, I had established that he's 80-plus years old at this time. Daniel chapter, this is a story that if you grew up in a Christian home, you probably heard ever since you were a little baby. Daniel in the lion's den. Very famous, but I think there's something that, there's a lot here that applies to us. The first couple lessons, again, I felt applied to young people with Daniel purposing and the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego not bowing down. But this here lesson, Daniel as an elderly man, I think is applicable especially to older folks and really to all of us. It can be a challenge to all ages. All right, so to establish this, a little bit of background again, we have the Medes and Persians. We have King Cyrus. Let me get my laser on here. I shared this last night. He became king of Persia, and then he went up and conquered his grandfather, the king of the Medes, and kind of took control. Now, if you remember the visions last night, we had the bear raised up one side. That would represent Cyrus and the Persian Empire, and also the ram with the two horns, the one that was higher. The higher one came up later. That would represent Cyrus, King Cyrus of Persia, and he controlled. And then, I think two nights ago, we talked about how he took control of the city of Babylon, where Daniel was captive, and when Belshazzar was having his feast, drinking out of the vessels from the temple, upstream, the Euphrates River ran right through the middle of Babylon. This is an artist's rendition of it, and they channeled the water from the Euphrates out, diverted the water from the Euphrates into a marshy area so that the water level dropped, and soldiers from both ends stormed into the city. The gates actually entering into the city were left unlocked, because people assume it's because they were at the Nebuchadnezzar or Belshazzar's party, and they took the city without much of a fight at all. Said there's very little bloodshed, but Belshazzar himself did pass away in that. All right, so now we get to Daniel chapter 6, verse 1. And it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom. So now we've switched. This is right after chapter 5. Now Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar is no longer in control. The Babylonian Empire has fallen. Now the Medes and Persians are in control. And there's some discrepancy on who this fellow Darius is. And if you remember Belshazzar, there was no archaeological evidence for a man by the name of Belshazzar until the 1850s. They found that cylinder that identified him as Nabonidus' son that ruled for him, validating the Bible. But Darius, we have the opposite problem. There's at least 6 people that were rulers in the Medes and Persians that are named Darius. So some people think he may have been a name, or it meant, I think, I wrote it somewhere. Let's see here in my notes. But if I remember, it meant like king or leader. It was like a title for the person in charge. So it pleased Darius. Some people think it was Cyrus, just another name or title for Cyrus. Others think it was a man by the name of Gubaru, which was his name, Gubaru. But he was the general of King Cyrus's armies, the one that actually was in charge of attacking Babylon. And then Cyrus put him in charge. Some think that was just another name for Gubaru as well. There's debate on that between scholars. All right, let's keep going. Verse 2. And over these 3 presidents, of whom Daniel was first, that the princes might give accounts unto them, and the king should have no damage. So Darius is in control. No matter whether he was Cyrus or whether he was Gubaru, we know he was in control from what the Bible tells us. And there was Daniel and two other presidents. This was the order of their government. You have Darius, you have Daniel and two other presidents, and you have 120 princes. And in verse 3 it says, "Then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm." I want to, verse 2 in the New King James, it says, "And over these three governors of whom Daniel was one." I don't think he was actually superior to the other two presidents. I think he was on an equal plane with the other two presidents. But because of his excellent spirit, King Darius wanted to set Daniel over top the whole realm. And I like us to think a little bit about an excellent spirit. What comes to your mind when you think of an excellent spirit? What kind of qualities? Humble? Confident? Mm-hmm. Job well done, yes. Do you think you would be grumbling and complaining when it was raining 5 days straight? Or when things weren't going well? Yes, exactly. Someone that's upbeat, someone that's cheerful. And it's a challenge to me, would your friends, would your family, would your boss, would they say, your neighbors, would they say you have an excellent spirit in you? It's a challenge. First challenge I'd like to take away from tonight. Verse 4, "And the presidents and the princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom." So they were jealous of Daniel's excellent spirit, I believe. But they could find none occasion or fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. They couldn't find an occasion for fault. And this was his co-workers. They were, I think you could call them his co-workers. There was 120 of the princes. There was the three presidents. They couldn't find a fault against him. There was no error. And I challenge us in that. If your coworkers were getting together to have a meeting and trying to find fault with you, could they find something? Do you think Daniel was always on time, always did more than was asked of him, always had good ideas that worked out well, respected others, lived an upright life, was honest, never cheated? I don't know, like they couldn't find fault with him. If they were going to trash him to the king to try to demote him, surely they could have thought up of something, but they couldn't. And I think that should be that's a very high standard. I think that's a challenge that we should try for ourselves, to live a life that people cannot find fault or error, that we can be faithful. Verse 5, "Then said these men, we shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God." So they knew Daniel would follow his God. Can your coworkers, can your family, can your neighbors say the same thing? So they can't find a fault with his character, but they know, at the same time, they know that he's going to be faithful to God no matter what. And that's how they're going to try to trip him up. I think that's an inspiring standard. Then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king and said unto King Darius, "Live forever." And that's just, I guess, a typical way of greeting a king. We've seen that earlier in Daniel. Verse 7, "And all the presidents of the kingdom, the governors, the princes, the counselors, the captains, have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, save of thee, O king, he shall be cast into the den of lions." You know, it says there they consulted together, or they go up to the king and they tell him they have consulted together. They missed one main important guy. That was Daniel himself. They didn't all consult together. It says that all the presidents' kingdoms, they've all gathered. They left out Daniel, obviously. Verse 8, "Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing that it be not changed according to the law of Medes and Persians, which altereth not. Wherefore, King Darius, sign the writing and the decree." So in the Babylonian Empire, what we see of Nebuchadnezzar, he could kind of do whatever he wanted. He could make a decree, he could change it. He was in control. At the Medes and Persians, they had this law that once a king issued a decree, it could not be changed. It says, "The law which altereth not." And we have an example of that in the Bible in Esther, where the king issues a decree in verse 8, "For the writing which is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's ring may no man reverse." He had issued a decree that the Jews could be killed on a certain day. And so instead of voiding that law or changing that law, the only thing he can do is make another law. And in verse 13 it says, "In every province as published unto all the people, and that the Jews should be ready against that day to avenge themselves on their enemies." So This was indeed a real thing. There's a extra biblical account about a Persian king who sentenced a man to death, but later, before his execution, realized the man was innocent, and he couldn't undo what he had done by his own royal authority. The man ended up being executed. So it was indeed a real, and extra biblical sources confirm this. It was a real law. Once a law was made, it could not be changed. Altereth not. Verse 10. Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went to his house, and his windows being open in his chamber towards Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetime. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. So Daniel continues doing what would have been wrong with Daniel just keeping his windows closed and just praying inside. I was thinking about that today. He was in a very influential place. Why wouldn't he just keep his windows shut? Nobody would see him. But I think it would have appeared to his coworkers that he was fearing the king and he was obeying the decree to stop praying, because he always prayed with his windows open towards Jerusalem. We see from Daniel here he was not afraid to live out his faith. Even though it was going to cost him potentially his life, he wasn't afraid to live out his faith. In 2 Chronicles 6, it talks about when Solomon is talking here, and when they're carried away into land captive, that in verse 38, or it says that how if they will pray unto thee in the land of captive, saying, we have sinned, we have done amiss and dealt wickedly, if they return to thee with all their heart and with all their soul in the land of captivity, whither they have carried them captives, and pray towards their land. I think that's where we see that he was praying towards Jerusalem. I think he knew what Solomon had written in 2 Chronicles, to pray towards Jerusalem, and we see him doing that here. I wonder also, in Jeremiah it talks about after 70 years accomplished, that God knows the thoughts that, or he thinks towards them, and that he's going to cause them to return to the place. And I think Daniel knew that time was about up. I wonder if he wasn't every day praying 3 times a day towards Jerusalem, you know, envisioning his people being let to go back to the promised land. All right, let's talk about this verse 10 a little bit. And there's several things I'd like to challenge us on. Do you kneel in prayer? Daniel kneeled upon his knees, very clearly. He knelt on his knees 3 times a day, and he prayed. Other examples in Scripture. Jesus knelt in the garden, Luke 22, verse 41. Paul knelt with the elders of Ephesus, Acts 20, verse 36. Paul knelt with his disciples at Tyre in Acts 21. In Ephesians 3, it says, I bow my knees unto the Father. We have numerous biblical accounts of kneeling to pray. And I'm not saying God's not going to hear your prayers as much if you're sitting, but it's an act of humility. It's a posture of humility. And I was challenged about this with studying this the last number of weeks. And I used to pray with Isaac, my 3-year-old, before bed, and he would be laying in bed, and I'd just be beside the bed. And I started getting him to kneel beside the bed beside me because of this. But I think it's a position of reverence and of humility. And I think it's something that would be good to pass on to our children, and to teach them. So I challenge you with that example. Daniel was 80 plus. I'm sure it wasn't easy to be on his knees 3 times a day praying, but that's how he did. 3 times a day. We have a little bit other in Psalm 55. It talks about that. Evening and morning and at noon I will pray and cry aloud, and he shall hear my voice. You know, we pray at our meals, but you take intentional time to pray 3 times a day. That's a challenge. Daniel was as busy as a man got. He was like of the top 3 below the king. He had a lot of responsibility. He had things to do, places to be, people to meet. But he took time to pray 3 times a day. In the Didache, one of the earliest Christian writings we have after the time of Christ, it says, thrice a day pray ye in this fashion. And then it quotes the Lord's Prayer. And that's another account of some support for early church praying, being intentional 3 times a day. And I challenge you to do that. He gave thanks, another challenge. And even during this time where there was a death threat for him praying, he gives thanks. He chooses to give thanks. And I challenge us, I shared this verse the other night when Daniel gave thanks in chapter 2. But in everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus concerning you. It's God's will that you're thankful. And I challenge you in that. Verse 11, I want you to notice one more thing before we go on to the next verse. And these men assembled. It seems, I always, as a little boy, I pictured this group of 120 princes, however many of them were out there. They were 3 blocks down, peeking around the corner with a pair of binoculars, seeing if Daniel was praying. But I don't think that's the case at all. If you look it up in Strong's, it means to gather tumultuously. So So it's almost like Daniel was praying from his maybe second story window. That's just the idea I have in my head. Maybe it was first floor. But here's this group of princes out there mocking and saying, "We got you, Daniel. We're going to the king." They gathered tumultuously. And we'll see that word come up again here when they arrive at the king's palace. So I think it gives a little more of a picture of what may be happening here. Daniel chapter 6, verse 12. "Then he came near and spake before the king concerning the king's decree. Hast thou not signed a decree that every man that shall ask a petition of any god or man within 30 days save thee, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions?" The king answered and said, "The thing is true according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not." Verse 13, "Then answered they and said before the king, that Daniel, which is of the children of the captivity of Judah." It seems like they almost despise Daniel. Okay? They're like, "That Daniel, which is of the children, which is the captives of the Jews, regardeth not thee, O king, nor the decree that thou hast signed, but maketh his petition 3 times a day. There's some scholars that think that even the gold statue in chapter 3, where everyone's commanded to bow down, that was rigged by the advisors to get rid of Daniel's 3 friends. And here we certainly see a case where they're intentionally trying to get rid of Daniel. Verse 14, "Then the king, when he heard these words, was sore displeased with himself, and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him." I picture that he called his best lawyer. He labored down till the sun went down. He tried every way. Isn't there any way we can change this law to spare Daniel's life? He tries, he's very upset with himself, and he's trying his heart. But the law of the Medes and Persians, you could not change it. He labored till the sun, going down with the sun. Verse 15, "Then the men assembled unto the king and said unto the king, Know, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians is that no decree or statute which the king established may be changed." So here comes 120 princes, and they're just rubbing it in the king's face. They're like, "King, you know you can't change this law. Let's get on with this." And again, it says that the word assembled is to gather tumultuously. So I picture this rowdy group of guys. All right. Verse 16. "Then the king commanded, and he brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions." I wonder what that was like. Do you think, like, it seems like they were almost friends. Or like, this was Darius' best employee. Somebody that he was thinking to set up over the whole realm. And he's working tirelessly to get him out of this predicament. And I'm sure Darius felt terrible. I mean, it was his response. He was responsible. He's the one that made that law. But he couldn't change it. There's nothing he could do about it. And so I wonder if they gave each other a hug. I don't know what it was like. I wonder if the king was apologizing. We don't have all those details. But and then the king spake and said unto Daniel, "Thy God, whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee." I think it would have been an interesting scene to see. And notice what kind of a witness Daniel was. Here's this pagan king. He's saying this to Daniel, his final words, what could be very well his final words. He says, "Thy God, whom thou servest continually." This pagan king knew that Daniel served this God continually. And Darius is confident, he appears confident, that God will deliver him. What a testimony Daniel was. Verse 17, "And a stone was brought and laid upon the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet, and with the signet of his lords, that the purpose might not be changed concerning Daniel." Stones rolled over the mouth of the den. And the king went into his palace and passed the night fasting. Neither was music of instrument brought before him, and his sleep went from him. And Daniel likely slept better than Darius. He probably even had a literal cat nap with the cats or with the lions. Verse 19, "Then the king rose up early in the morning and went in haste to the den of lions." So the king gets up. He can't sleep that night. They bring a guy with a harp, I would envision, or some kind of instrument. They try to play instruments to get him to sleep. He can't sleep. He gets up early in the morning and goes in haste to the den of lions. Verse 20, "When he came to the den, he cried with a lamentable voice unto Daniel. And the king spake and said to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God, whom thou servest continually, able to deliver thee from the lions?" Daniel's response, verse 21, "Then said Daniel unto the king, O king, live forever. My God hath sent his angel and hath shut the lion's mouth, that they have no hurt and have not hurt me. Forasmuch as before him innocency was found in me, and also before thee, O king, have I done no hurt. Then was the king exceeding glad for him, and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no manner of hurt was found on him, because he believed in his God. Hebrews echoes that same thought in verse 11:33, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions. It says, so 23, verse 23, because he believed God, there was no hurt, and because of his faith, in Hebrews 11, identify that as the reason Daniel was not hurt, because of his faith. Story goes on. And the king commanded, and they brought the men which had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives, and the lions had mastery over them, and break all their bones in pieces, or ever they had came to the bottom of the den. And you can't reason that the lions weren't hungry. It says that their bones were broken before they even touched the bottom of the den. So it wasn't like the, skeptics can't say, well, the lions had just been fed, therefore they left Daniel alone. No, that's not the case at all. This totally, God takes care of any chance of people saying that. Verse 25. Then King Darius wrote unto the people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and steadfast forever in his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end. This isn't the first decree that's happened. Verse 30:27. He delivereth and rescueth, and he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and in earth, who hath delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. Nebuchadnezzar had issued a decree in chapter 3. He wrote chapter 4 testifying of God, all because of Daniel's influence. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're the difference they were making. In the last verse of Daniel chapter 6, so this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Wow, what a fascinating story. What an inspiration for us that we can be faithful. Even this 80-plus year old made such a difference in the kingdom, set such an example for us. All right, I want to change the subject completely here. And one of my favorite topics is Jesus in the Old Testament. Looking at shadows of Christ in the Old Testament. And you look at accounts like Genesis 22, where Abraham offered his son Isaac on the altar. And that is a very, that's a whole evening topic. But that's a very clear foreshadow of Christ. Where the altar was built is very likely the same spot where Jesus was crucified. There is Moses as a shadow of Christ, or like a shadow of Christ. There's the Passover lamb that very clearly, in Colossians, it calls Christ our Passover. Jesus in Matthew 12 says, as for Jonah was 3 days and three nights in a whale's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. And last year, I listened to a message by Chuck Pike, and he was saying how the early church often referenced Daniel chapter 6 as being a foreshadow of Christ. And so I'm going to just put some of the reasons up here, and we can kind of see a parallel between Jesus and between Daniel. They were both from the tribe of Judah. Daniel was the wisest man in Babylon. Jesus was the wisest, in Matthew 12:42. Daniel was one of three presidents. Jesus is one of the Trinity. Daniel is in command next to the king. Jesus sits next to the Father. There was no fault found in Daniel, and there was no fault found in Jesus. The law was used to find fault with Daniel, and we just read that story tonight, and the same with Jesus in John 19. They used the law to try to accuse him. The princes set a trap for Daniel to be killed, and the same with Jesus. The leaders, Jewish leaders, set a trap for Jesus. Daniel prayed three times a day, as we read tonight. Jesus prayed three times in the garden. Daniel prayed towards the temple, and I think it's likely that Jesus was praying for the towards the temple when he was in the Garden of Gethsemane, and they both knelt to pray. Daniel was found praying by his people that wanted to have him killed, and Jesus was found praying when Judas came to betray him. Darius and Pilate, both the people, the leaders in charge, both wanted to set the men free. There was a stone on the den of the lions, and there was a stone at the mouth of the tomb. Both times, the stone was sealed. Daniel departed early in the morning, or King Darius came early in the morning, got Daniel out, and early in the morning, Christ was risen. A concerned individual came early in the morning to check. That was Darius, and then it was the ladies that came to the tomb, and both were shocked by what they found. An angel ministered to both of them in their time of need. The angel in in the lion's den. It kept the mouth of the lions shut, and an angel that came and strengthened Jesus. Not a bone was broken on Daniel or on Jesus. And bones were broken of the princes that were cast in the lion's den, and also the two thieves on the either side of Jesus on the cross. Verse 25 says, unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell on the earth. Matthew 28, verse 19 says, go therefore and teach all nations. And both testify that God's kingdom will not be destroyed. And both were delivered from death. So that's just an interesting little side note on just Daniel as a foreshadow of Jesus. That's a fascinating subject if you want to get into that. All right, we have about 12 minutes left of class. I could hardly teach go through Daniel without touching on the prophecy of the 70 weeks, probably the best known prophecy. There's varying opinions on it. So I put a quote here by Alistair Begg from one of the commentaries I have. And he says, in what follows, I reserve the right to change my mind later this evening and as often as necessary for the rest of my life until I finally settle the matter. What I'm about to now unfold will annoy some, disappoint others, confuse many, and perhaps encourage a few. Daniel chapter 9. It's a prophecy of the 70 weeks. And basically, it's a prophecy that predicts, I think, to the day when Jesus comes. And we'll get to that. Just a little bit of the setting. Daniel 9, verse 1. In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus of the seed of the Medes, which was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by books the number of the years. Wherefore, the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah the prophet that he would accomplish the 70 weeks in the desolations of Jerusalem. And I set my face unto the Lord God to seek by prayer and supplications with fasting and sackcloth and ashes. And I prayed unto the Lord my God and made my confession and said, O Lord, the great and dreadful God, keeping the covenant and mercy to them that love him and to them that keep his commandments. And he goes on praying and says in verse 20, while I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God for the holy mountain of God, yea, while I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in a vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, touched me about the time of the evening oblation. And he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I am now come forth to give thee skill and understanding. At the beginning of my supplication, thy supplications, the commandment came forth, and I am come to show thee, for thou art greatly beloved. Therefore understand the matter and consider the vision. Notice Daniel is greatly beloved by God. And then Gabriel gives him the vision in verse 24. 70 weeks, and I'm not going to get into a big debate on this, but 70 weeks would stand for 70 weeks of years. Okay, the Amplified Version would translate 70 weeks of years or 490 years. I can give you a resource to have that explained. 70 weeks of years are determined upon thy people and upon the holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, and to make reconciliation for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks. Okay? From the going forth, let me just put this up here. So Daniel's vision was 538. Artaxerxes' command to go rebuild the walls happened March 5th. And for these dates, I'm using this book, Chronological Aspects of the Life of Christ by Harold Honer. There's many different opinions, but I'm going to present his first. It shall be 70 weeks. Shall be 7 weeks. And 62 weeks, in other words, a total of 69 weeks, and the street shall be built again, and the wall even in troublous times. So we have 69 weeks of year, and the ancient calendars were 360 days in a year. And that's supported by the count in Genesis, the flood, and also Revelations 11. There's another example of a 360 days in a year. So I'm not going to get into a lot of the details on that. But if you would take 69 weeks until to finish the transgression, make an end of sins, and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah, the Prince. So we're looking at, for 69 weeks, we're looking for 7 plus 62. And if you take that 360 days in a year, so we take 69 for weeks of days, 69 times 7. And I have the wrong label in here. It should be 483 years. You take 483 times 360. It comes to 173,880 days until the coming of the Messiah. And that's what we get to. The triumphant entry, Harold Honer makes a very strong case in here that the triumphant entry held out to exactly 173,880 days later, and Jesus would have come in on a triumphant entry on March 30th, 33 AD. He builds a strong case for that. saying Daniel prophesied to the day. It's an inspiring study how Jesus was correctly predicted when he would come. Let's keep reading the last two verses here. And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. It's talking about Jesus. Messiah was cut off. He was after 62 weeks, or in other words, plus the 7 that happened in the verse before. So 69 weeks. The Messiah is going to be cut off, not for himself. Jesus didn't die for himself. He died for us. The people of the prince shall come, destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood. Unto the end of the war, desolations are determined. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause a sacrifice and oblation to cease. And for the overspreading of abominations he will make it desolate, even unto the consummation. And that determined shall be poured out upon the desolate. So the view from Harold Honer's book here would be just like I showed a diagram a little bit earlier. March 5th, 444 would have been the decree to go rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. To the day, the amount of days later, 69 weeks to the day would be March 30th. He makes the case for that was Jesus' triumphant entry into Jerusalem. And then Jesus dies. And then this view, Harold Honer's view, there's a gap between the 69th week and the 70th week. And then the 70th week would be when the mark of the beast comes. That's like a premillennial view. And you can also, if you want to listen to more on this in much more detail than what I just shared, you can listen to Mike Winger's video on Daniel 9, God's Countdown. It's in his Evidence of the Bible series. And also this book, Chronological Aspects of the Life of Christ, present that. I shared this quote last night about from the early church writer right around the year 160 that there are whether Jerusalem is going to be rebuilt or not. And I just highlight at the bottom, many who belong to the pure and pious faith and are true Christians think otherwise. So there's other true Christians that think otherwise than what I briefly explained. I just summarize that. They would view that the 69 weeks was until Jesus was baptized, and then he was baptized around the year 27. This just kind of summarizes it. And then the 70 weeks are finished. When Stephen is martyred, when the gospel gets spread to the Gentiles, is another very common view called amillennialism. But either way, we can be pure and pious Christians no matter which view we take. I think it's a pitfall to not study it at all, but it's also a pitfall to be wrapped in it too much that you get so tangled up as well. But it's something good to study. All right, let's just summarize briefly. Daniel, as we looked at the book of Daniel this week, one of the first things we had was to purpose. And we had in chapter 1 how Daniel and his three friends purposed not to eat the king's meat. And then in chapter 3 we have his three friends. They didn't bow down to the golden idol. They stood strong for God. And tonight we looked at Daniel chapter 6 where Daniel continued praying. He didn't just shut his window. He didn't give in to the king, but he continued praying. He purposed to do what was right. And I challenge us as we go from here in our lives, that we purpose to do what's right, to live for God, to not eat the king's meat, to not bow down to idols, continue praying, continue persevering. Another theme we've seen in the book of Daniel is Daniel was a man of prayer. In chapter 2, when the king said, you have to tell me the dream and the interpretation, remember he called a prayer meeting with his three friends, probably in the middle of the night. Tonight we looked at how he prayed three times a day. And in chapter 9, it talks about Daniel praying for his people. Chapter 10, he's praying and fasting for 3 weeks, I think it is. There's examples of him praying, and I challenge us that we can be like that. We can be men and ladies of prayer. And then the last thing we looked at, or the last theme I've been trying to emphasize, is prophecy. We have Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 2, where we had the image of with the head of gold, chest of silver, waist of bronze, and then legs of iron. Last night we looked at the four beasts in chapter 7, also prophecy, and the ram and goat in chapter 8, prophesied as well. Remember, there was an excellent spirit found in Daniel, as we read about tonight, and he was a man greatly beloved by God. And hopefully Daniel is an inspiration to you, and that you can be inspired by his life. I'll open it up just for a minute. Is there anything that stood out to anyone here that you'd like to share? I'd like to hear different perspectives or anything from what we shared this week in the life of Daniel.